It helps me talk about things better because I like understand the system now rather than just the button that they're asking me to design or like whatever it is or the screen at the time, you know?
What's up, OUXers? Today we're talking to Cassie Eddy, who is a UX designer and researcher at Health Catalyst and certified OUX strategist. Kind of rhymes. Catalyst, strategist. Yeah, cool. She's also a shining star of our OUX mentor program. She mentored, I believe, cohort 4 and is coming back to mentor cohort 6 at the beginning of the year. So just another reason to get on the wait list to join cohort 6. That'll be, I think we'll be opening up enrollment in November-ish, early December to start up in January. Ish. So go to oux.com/waitlist to get on the waitlist for cohort 6, which Cassie will be a part of as a mentor. So today, Cassie and I are going to talk about learning to code as a UXer, CrossFit, and the information architecture of CrossFit, combining passions, and of course, object-oriented UX. So Cassie she's got just so much wisdom to share, and I hope you really enjoy the episode. Before we jump in, just a few announcements on OUX developments that are happening over here. So one thing I want to talk to you about is just some new thinking on grouping versus sorting and filtering. A potential new color introduced into the object map. Crazy. And a new collaboration that's happening. And a slight change to the podcast schedule. So, first of all, a lot of great questions and thoughts are coming out of Cohort 5 office hours. So shout out to Cohort 5. Y'all are awesome. I absolutely live for those Q&A sessions. I think they're just so much fun. And they often turn into these nice little geeky group discussions. So Aliyev in particular, she brought up sorting and filtering versus grouping. And that turned into a whole rabbit hole of a conversation. I don't really have any answers about this, but I just want to go over real quick, the differences between sorting and filtering and grouping, and just some things to think about when you're thinking about combining these. So just to level set here, filtering is when you have a list of instances of an object and you narrow down that list, usually by leveraging some metadata. Sorting is when you have a list of instances of an object and you change the order, usually also by leveraging some metadata. You can use the same metadata to sort and filter. For example, price is a great example. I might filter my products that I'm looking at by price, like only show me products that are between $50 and $100. And then I might sort within that by price as well. So now sort it by the least expensive to the most expensive. Or I might filter by price and then sort by something else. So sort by rating. So filter by only show me products between $50 and $100 and then show me the highest rated products at the top of that list. So we're pretty comfortable with combining sorting and filtering. Now we've started thinking a little bit more about group by. Group by is an interesting one. It's basically a sort when you don't have that clear gradient like you would have for price. Like you have a clear high and low and everything in between, like price or rating or popularity, like another kind of rating, right? So even like number of followers or something like that, you might sort by. Grouping is like, I kind of want to sort by something that has these distinct categories, like status. So in the system, status might have 4 values, right? Draft, published, archived, and flagged or something like that. So like pulled for review. Okay, so I might want to see all, let's say articles. I might want to see articles if that's our object, all at once. So I don't want to filter by status, but sorting doesn't make a whole lot of sense because it's like there's only 4 values, right? Another one is like by category. Let's say you have a category and there's like 5 different categories and there's no clear top and bottom. Sort by doesn't make a whole lot of sense. All right. So group by makes more sense. It's basically you're grouping the instances by those categories or those status values or something like that. And then we got into the conversation of when you get into group by, like, would you want to sort or filter within that? So you have your groupings, and then within the groupings potentially show. So if I have, I want to group my products by category so I can see all five categories all at once. And then within each group, I want to sort them by price, right? So we'll see more of that in kind of business to business tools or admin tools. Like, you know, our power users might use that. But it turned into a whole lot of interesting conversations. Let me know if you want to hear more about this. If you want to kind of reach out to me on Twitter at SophiaVUX. Maybe I'll write an article or something on that. But or if you have any thoughts on this or any good examples of kind of combining sorting and grouping and even filtering. And if there's already any kind of best practices that you know about that already exist, I would be interested to know about that. So something to think about when you're thinking about a list of objects, don't just think about sort and filter. Think about that group by as well. And also watch out for saying you want to sort by something that doesn't have a clear top and bottom or a high and low, right? That will probably be a group by. All right, you're just diving right in, huh? Okay, the other thing that we've been talking a lot about in cohort 5 is proxy relationships. So what is a proxy relationship? So this is a relationship between two objects that is actually connected by proxy through another object. So examples help, all right? So an example from Ali O, so we have Ali F and Ali O. So Ali O is working on a pet project during cohort 5, a pet project in more ways than one, because it's a cat behavior tracker that she's been wanting to produce for a while and decided to use this as her design challenge within the certification program. So in her tool, she has an object for behavior. So an instance of that would be peeing on the couch or scratching the chair. An activity report like Zeke peed on the couch yesterday at 5:34 p.m. after the Amazon guy came. So I'm going to log an activity report and I'm going to associate a behavior to that. Right. So I'm going to say this behavior happened and here's some notes and here's when it happened. And a cat has many activity reports associated. So here's Zeke and here's all the activity reports. So a cat is connected to behaviors, but only by proxy through the activity report. So when we're looking in the nested object matrix, it just seems like everybody wants to give something like this a special color. So gray is actually one out. So if you find yourself in this situation where you have these by proxy relationships and you still want to document it in your nested object relationship, but you realize that that relationship is actually through another object, feel free to leverage a gray sticky note or a white sticky note, I guess, if you're using animal. I've never actually seen a gray sticky note in print. So gray might not be the best color for when we go back to the real world. We know that there's white sticky notes, so maybe gray or white. So basically, we can still talk about that in the nested object matrix, so those proxy relationships, and kind of make sure that we are cognizant that this is not a direct relationship. So I might see Zeke and see here's all the behaviors that Zeke is having a problem with, but it's only because I've logged activity reports that tag that behavior. Okay, so the activity report is sort of the connective tissue between a cat and a behavior. Okay, all right. You might be asking, why is this important? Why do I actually care about proxy relationships? Well, what this tells me, if I'm saying that behavior is a proxy relationship, what it's telling me is that behaviors are automatically showing up on a cat's profile based on activity reports. This could also be a direct relationship. Now, if I wanted it to be a direct relationship where the user actually tags the cat with the behaviors that are a problem and tags the cat manually, that's totally different functionality versus those behaviors automatically showing up. So that's the kind of thing we want to think about when we're thinking about proxy relationships. Okay, so business announcements. First, I don't really understand the whole podcast season thing. I think it's basically I don't know. I don't actually, I don't understand podcast seasons. And I don't want to take an official between seasons break, but we are going to be slowing our roll a little bit to every 3 weeks, at least in through the end of the year, because we have a very big project that we're working on and we want to make sure that we have plenty of time to focus on cohort 5 and make progress with that big project. And that big project is, drum roll, a collaboration with Jonah Tolle, the UX guy on Udemy. So this is very cool. Joe and I met in a clubhouse, like, I don't know, panel discussion, I guess, earlier this year. He totally got the value of OOUX, which was super validating because he's been teaching UX design for, I don't know, like 20 years or something. And has just been in the industry a while. He's a real heavy hitter. And he totally, just OOUX totally clicked for him. And after we had a few discussions, we decided to do a course together. So we are doing an OOUX fundamentals course, shooting for something around 5 to 7 hours. So for those of you that are not ready for the time and money investment of the OOUX masterclass and want a more introductory program, this is going to be a great option. So you can get on the wait list to be the first to know about this. We'll probably do some amazing promotion for those on the wait list. You can go to OOUX.com/product/fundamentals. We'll of course put the link in the description for you, but you can get on that waitlist and be the first to know about that. Okay, I know that was a lot. Let's go talk to Cassie. Welcome to the Object Oriented UX podcast, a podcast about tackling complexity head on, gracefully organizing massive amounts of information, and designing scalable, future-proof, and of course, naturally intuitive object-oriented user experiences. An OOUXer is a powerful blend of information architect, business analyst, facilitator, and UX strategist. If this sounds like you or what you aspire to, you are so in the right place. I'm Sophia Prater, UX designer, chief evangelist of Object-Oriented UX, and your host. Let's jump into it. Cassie Eddy, welcome to the Object-Oriented UX podcast.
Thanks, Sophia. I'm so excited to be here.
So good to have you. Okay, so we'll start with CrossFit. All right, we'll get to Object-Oriented UX. We'll get to UX design, but let's start with CrossFit because As I was going back in your LinkedIn history, I mean, I know from just knowing you that you're into CrossFit and you're into fitness, but I didn't know that you have your master's degree in health informatics. And then you got a degree in exercise science, and you've also been a CrossFit coach on and off throughout the years. And even before that, it looks like your high school degree was actually specific to health sciences. Is that all right?
Yeah. You got all that right. Yeah.
So can you tell me a little bit about what you love about the fitness world and also why you decided actually to go back to school and to get more of a nerdy degree in information science?
Yeah. So, I mean, for fitness, I got super interested in it because I was pretty unhealthy for most of my childhood. And then I got to high school and I had some awesome gym teachers who kind of taught me the importance of exercise and eating right. And they like completely changed my life. So my lifestyle changed. I got really into fitness, started feeling a lot better. And I just wanted to help other people do that for themselves. And so when I was going to college, I decided to study exercise science for that reason. And then started studying that and realized that like a lot of the determinants of health have a lot to do with more like social factors. So I got into sociology as well. And I wanted to bridge the two. So then I started thinking a lot about public health and systems and technology. And that's why I chose health informatics, because it kind of pulls all those things together.
It does pull all those things together. I mean, even sociology. So that's really interesting, the kind of combination between health sciences and fitness and sociology. There's definitely a lot. I mean, sociology and even kind of ethnographic research and how we like, I mean, sociology is sort of why people are the way they are and how, you know, how does behavior actually work, which I'm sure that plays into your work as a UX designer. So that's very cool. So did you actually study sociology?
Yeah. So I actually double majored in college in exercise science and sociology.
Wow. All right. Yeah. And so, yeah. And then when you decided to go back, so did you actually go into the working world before you went back for the information science degree?
Yeah. So I actually, it's funny, coming out of college, I was super involved in research, like pretty much from, I think the first semester I got there, I thought I wanted to be a PhD. And so got super into doing exercise science research, did a little bit of sociology stuff. And then for the year after college, I worked in a lab that focused on the physiology of firefighting and kind of trying to understand how to deploy tech in live fire situations. So we were basically giving them heart rate monitors and trying to see if they could use that information to keep their guys safer. And through that experience, I just kind of realized that I wanted to be more on the implementation side. So like, I felt like there was a lot of knowledge that we were producing in research that just like didn't get read by anybody, wasn't used by like my mom and my dad and people that I cared about, you know? And so I wanted to be on the side of someone who is taking that research and trying to implement actual solutions. So that's how I kind of stumbled across health informatics.
Wow. So you were really good about taking all of these interests and blending them together, which I feel like is unique. I think a lot of people have these diverse interests. You know, we as human beings, we contain multitudes, right? Yeah. So we have all these diverse interests, but I think that a lot of folks have problems figuring out how to merge them together and how to, like, do you have any advice for those people that are like, oh, I love this over here and I love this over here, but how do I match that up?
Yeah, that's a great question. No one's ever asked me that actually. let me think for a sec. So yeah, I think for me, I've always tried to figure out everything that I come into contact with. Like I've always been kind of more of a generalist and wanting to do a million different things, but I try to look for like the core of what it is I like about something. So for example, with like research, right? Like I thought I wanted to be a PhD, but then I realized like the core of what I like about this is that I want to help people and I want it to be health related. And that's how I kind of was able to transfer that and say like, okay, like how do I help people in a health related way? And with tech. So I would say like, look for the thing that you really like about stuff that you're seeing around and then just like talk to people out in the world. Like I spent a lot of time just like talking to a bunch of different people, meeting people, you know, seeing what they were doing. And I also tried to not limit myself. Like I always kind of in the back of my head was thinking, you know, if I don't find anything, maybe I'll just learn a bunch of different things and cobble them together on my own. And I think I just got lucky. Yeah.
No, I don't think it was just that you were getting lucky. I think you did. That's great advice of like kind of looking for the nugget. Like, what is it about this thing that I love so much? Really getting clear on that, getting a lot of clarity on what it is you love about the thing. Talking to a bunch of people and then just continuing to learn. And it sounds like you just sort of trust it, like trust in the process. If I keep continue to learn about these things, continue to just follow your curiosity. And eventually the path will sort of lead you to where they cut all the paths come together. So let's talk about your work at Health Catalyst now.
Yeah.
So tell me about Health Catalyst. What does Health Catalyst do and what is your role within Health Catalyst?
Yeah. So, we do a lot of stuff. Started as, mostly kind of like a data warehousing company. So, work with health systems, pull in all their data from different sources, like over hundreds of sources into one kind of single source of truth in a data warehouse. And on top of that, we have a lot of applications that help different folks within the health system do things. So we have things for like revenue cycle management. We have stuff for patient safety. And so it's really that it's like data analytics and some software in addition to that. So, kind of like some services as well, in addition to products. So we have this really cool, cool opportunities to think about like how our services actually wrap around some of the UI that we're thinking about. So it, you end up doing a little bit of service work there too. But my role, so I'm a UX designer and researcher. I think that's my official title. I started as an intern over 2 years ago, ended up working as just like a part-time designer as I was working my way through my master's degree. And then once I finished, I got a full-time offer. I kind of floated around a bunch of different teams doing mostly research for a while. First on the life sciences team and then kind of more generally on different initiatives. Recently really been pushing to also get into the code. So I've been given the opportunity on a couple of projects I worked on to actually do research design and some programming, which has been a huge goal of mine pretty much since grad school. Because I think it's fun to do all parts of the process and kind of plug in. So yeah, right now I was assigned to a new team that it's a bunch of different, it's like five different products, I think, all having to do with finance and revenue cycle management and healthcare. So looking at like different bills and making sure that you billed for everything that you would expect to, or you're not overbilling, or making sure you're using the right codes in the bills and managing the whole list of like items that you could possibly bill for at a hospital. It's another one of the products.
So pretty significant levels of complexity there.
Yeah. I think it is the most complex thing I'll ever encounter in my life, honestly, which is funny because I'm pretty young, but like I took one look at it and I was like, I don't think I've ever seen anything like this. Yeah. And other people feel the same.
Do you feel like after 2 years there, is that right? 2 years?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
After 2 years, do you feel like you've fully wrapped your head around it, around all the complexity? Or do you feel like there's just still so much? Do you feel like you're an expert in it?
Do I feel like an expert? I mean, that's hard. Cause I always think about like all the things I could learn. So I don't know if I'll ever feel like an expert, but I definitely feel like if I had to talk to someone about it and explain what the systems do, I could do that. I think it like some of the complexity is kind of added by like just the like tiny, tiny differences that different hospitals have with the way that they process data. And so like some of that, it's hard to say that you'll ever really, anyone could ever really understand the complexity, but I do understand the core, which is great. And I think it's largely because I took your course. So I was able to come in and kind of understand what the core of some of the software is.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, let's, there's like eight things that I want to talk about coming off of that. But like one thing that I thought was really interesting is how it sounds like when you work with these different hospitals, all of a sudden new stuff comes up, right? So you have your system, but now you have to apply it in a new context. And there's going to be new stuff to learn and new requirements and new ways to, I guess, implement the system for a hospital. So taking the Obduratory and UX certification course, cohort 3, woo, how did that help you kind of wrap your head around this complexity? How did that work?
Yeah, so I'm trying to think about the exact time I was taking it, but I remember I was still on the life sciences team at Health Catalyst, and that team is primarily taking de-identified data and trying to basically creating real world evidence and using that data. So basically data from a bunch of different health systems that's been de-identified, so you can't like see what the actual patient information is. And trying to do analytics and figure out like, can we see the way that this drug is actually working in the real world? Mm-hmm. And so trying to
work. Wait, the what?
Like drugs.
Oh, the drug.
Yeah.
I thought you said the shrug. It's like the shrug. Oh,
that's more fun.
Okay. But, okay. How those medicine. Okay. So, all right, mm-hmm. Please continue. I threw you off.
Oh no, you're good. So I think just understanding, it helped me really think about like the different mental models of the groups that we're interacting with. So on the one side, we have the data coming out of the health systems and they think about their data on an individual level. But then when we aggregate it, there's like a whole different set of things happening, right? We're trying to like harmonize all of these different things. And then we're trying to present it to pharmaceutical companies and they have a totally different mental model of thinking of it. And so it's like kind of bridging all these different, you know, worlds and trying to, it helped me like think about like, okay, what's the core thing that they're all thinking about? It's like the drug, there's a patient, there's a health system. And so I was able to kind of use it in that way. And they didn't really have many products that I was working on. It was kind of all hypothetical stuff to start because it's a pretty new group, but it at least helped me get a really firm grasp on like, what are the things that everyone in this stakeholder group cares about and what are we going to need to build, you know?
Right. So there can be a ton of complexity in something like a drug in a patient, right?
Yeah, right?
But understanding, okay, there is a drug, there's a concept of a drug, there's a concept of a patient, there's a relationship between those. There's also a relationship between the drug and the pharmaceutical company. And we can kind of start defining those things. And it sort of gives you, what I found is you can kind of encapsulate that complexity and say, okay, there's a lot of stuff going on within the drug and there's a lot of stuff going on within the patient, but I can sort of now stand back and see that bird's eye view. And then I can zoom in to those individual things and see how they all connect and kind of get to know them better. And to your point, get to know them better from different angles. So what does the drug look like from the pharmaceutical company versus a hospital or another user group?
Right. Right. Cool. It's like, yeah, like a clinician's, like they're trying to find the best treatment for their patient. Right. So they're thinking about all these different drugs, and maybe they're thinking about dosage and just like, how is this going to interact with other things that they're on, or is this the best thing?
So kind of like, so you said this, that you are relatively young. You're very young. So your degree, I also saw like a little, subtitle of your degree. It was like in user-centered agile software development. Yeah. Was part of that. And you're young enough to kind of remember that, actually. Like if you asked me about what I learned in college, that was way too long ago. So I'm just curious, like when you were getting this education in user-centered agile development, how did that, like when you went through the OUX masterclass, how did it compare? Like, was it like, wow, this is really different? Or were there things that you were like, oh, this is kind of what we were talking about? Maybe just, yeah, like how was it? So was the masterclass surprising after being through a degree like that?
I mean, it was just different. There wasn't a huge focus on like IA at all in my degree program. It was a lot about like just kind of having a concept for an app, doing some mockups, developing it on the fly, like a lot with, so that like kind of subtitle, the user-centered agile software development, basically just means that I did a bunch of coursework in design, also the healthcare side of things like public health and tech, and then some development. My capstone course was, I was on a team of, I think it was six of us, and we were like cross-disciplinary. So we were all UX designers, researchers, and coders basically on this project. And so we had to bring all the skills together, but it was really scrappy and fast. So like, it was basically like, okay, we're going to do a mock-up tonight and then build it tomorrow. So there was no like intent really behind like making sure everything's connected, or even like using like variables across like what are the different colors we're using the app. So pretty different. Like, yeah.
And do you think that there is a time and place for that kind of work, or like after, or do you feel like there should be more between, you know, let's do a mock-up and then going straight into development?
Yeah, I think it's better to have a really concrete idea of exactly what it is you're going to be creating. And I think OUX helps in that way, because it's not, you're not making the mock-up directly. You're like thinking about what the things are in the system. And so you're kind of like future-proofing it, right? Whereas like the way that we were doing it, it's like, okay, we're going to make this feature. Okay, we're going to make this feature. Yeah, stuff gets really messy that way.
Right. Yeah. So I was hanging out with Joe Natoli this weekend. So Joe Natoli is the UX guy on Udemy, and we will be doing a course together, which is exciting. And he gave me a copy of his book called Think First.
Awesome.
It's okay. Basically what you just said. It's like, think first and then design. Simply wrote a whole book on it. But yeah, like just, can we put a little bit of a pause before we get into mockups, so that we actually think about what we're mocking up? What are the things that are being represented in all these little bits of UI that we're designing? So you mentioned, I know we're jumping around a little bit, but I've got so many questions for you. So you mentioned that at Health Catalyst, now you're actually starting to get into the development side a bit. I'm curious to know what, like, was the opportunity given to you, or did you just start doing it? Cause you're doing this. This is not like little side project. I mean, you're doing this at work. You were starting to actually do programming work. How did that come about? Like, did the opportunity present itself and you just took it, or did you just start doing it and said, hey, I'm going to start doing this now?
Well, so the first opportunity I was given to do it, I had worked on, design for something on a colleague's app that he kind of just pulled me on because I wanted some experience, and he heard that I had some coding experience and there were just some styling fixes that he wanted, at interaction design fixes on the app, And so he kind of parlayed it for me and spoke to the head developer and was like, hey, she's got some skills and we seem to be strapped for resources. So why don't you let her write some code? And then they let me in and I just kind of started like fixing stuff. Like we would meet and he would say, try to fix this, this, this. And so that was kind of my first experience. And then this, like, I've been working on a bigger project recently. And that one was my boss kind of a manager. He had seen me write some code like a really long time ago, and he thought I might be good at doing it. And he's that kind of guy. So he actually does all the things. So he, I think he studied computer sciences in undergrad, and then he got a fine arts degree. And so ended up in like UX with also doing some programming on the side. So yeah, he was super supportive. He knew it's something I wanted to do. So he let me kind of do some of the design and then also development on this project.
Awesome. So my follow-up question to that is, so it sounds like you were given the opportunity and you took the opportunity and you're doing a lot of like learning too, right? Because when you first started this, you were sort of an amateur. Now you're, I guess, getting better and better at it through practice. How, like, what is your process for learning? Is it all just on the job learning? Are you like going home and watching YouTube videos? What are you doing?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I do a lot of like, I have a professional development schedule that I actually keep for myself on a Trello board.
That's awesome.
So, yeah. So like, I mean, this is something I've been wanting to do for a while. And so I had been kind of doing these little kind of like online courses in coding or programming. And specifically for this, it was written in Angular, the app that I recently was helping out with. And so I actually like gave myself a month long schedule and blocked out like lessons for each day and took a Udemy course that was pretty intense at the speed at which I was doing it. And so yeah, I just did that every night. And then once I was done, started working. And some of it transferred and some of it didn't. And I had to get really good at reading documentation, but that's a good skill to have. So
That's awesome. Calendar blocking for the win. That's so cool. Wow. And do you feel like, so now that you're in it, how is learning this affecting your work as a designer?
Oh, that's a great question. Yeah. So, I have to be kind of careful about when I'm designing now, where I like, I have to be in a design space and not thinking about the implementation. Cause then I might like not do something a certain way. Cause I know it's going to be harder to implement. But on the flip side of that, I feel like when I'm talking to a developer now, like we can communicate about why something's going to be hard and why I designed it a certain way. And we can switch it while keeping the intent the same, you know? So it makes that handoff a little bit easier. And then in terms of the actual development, it's just so fun to like be working on the app and have the actual data coming through. And you can see like, does my design hold up when I run the data through? And if it doesn't, let me switch this little thing. Or let me like interact with the app and see if like this really feels the way I intended it to. Cause it's different when you have it in like Figma or Axure versus like when you're dealing with a real app, with data. Yeah.
So in my UX Hustle talk, one thing that I talked about was actually prototyping the database. So as a way to sort of stress test your model. So, okay, you figure out your objects and their relationships, you figure out the attributes. You could just go in and start sketching or going and either like, so I would use Webflow or even Airtable because I don't know how to program, but as like just a kicking the tires of the system and then putting in some real instances or like uploading a CSV or something so I can start seeing actual real data sort of massaged into this model to see if it works. And it actually helps you bring up additional questions and have a better conversation with your developer to be like, hey, I hacked this thing together. This is what this brought up. Can we do this? How would this actually work? But you're doing it. You're just going straight into the code, which is amazing. Wow. That's really cool. Has it changed at all how you, or tell me a little bit about how, when you are working with your developers or working on a team, like where does object oriented, since we're on the object oriented UX podcast.
Yes.
yes, we are. How does OUX come into that collaboration?
It comes in and being able to communicate, honestly. It's funny, like right after I took your course, it must have been like a day after one of the lectures, I was on a call with someone and they were talking about a design. And they literally asked the question, is this a one to many or is this a one-to-one relationship? And I was able to be like, oh, I know that that's a one-to-one, you know, and here's why. And mm-hmm. it was like a relationship between a patient and event report, like an incident report. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, you could conceivably in the real world have like a many-to-one relationship or one-to-many relationship. But in this specific system, that was a constraint that we had placed on the form. So mm-hmm. I was able to have that conversation. He was able to say like, okay, that's how we're going to do it in the database then on the back end. So super.
Yeah. Helpful. And so like, and then with your kind of UX designer hat on, so to speak, you could even think of like, is that like, do we need to look in? Like so, some of those questions, it might be like, oh yeah, it's definitely a one to many. Sometimes you might say it is, that's how it works now in the system. But what actually makes sense for our end users? Maybe it should be a many to many or something like that.
Yeah, totally. The other thing too about that specific project was we had to go in and like change the way that the patient looked in every setting because we added a new type on like a person. We actually made it instead of a patient, a person. And then we had like visitor, patient, other. And so we came up with a visual indicator. And so I had the fun job of having to go around in the app and like figure out like, where is this object showing up? And like, let's make it consistent everywhere.
Wow. Okay.
So, yeah. Thankfully I was working with the main designer on this product, was super aware of everything was. And so we talked about that. That was the first thing we said, like, we need to make it consistent everywhere.
And in that particular, so that's a great example of using. So you have a person object that has type, mm-hmm. visitor, and probably some conditional logic, right? So if it's a patient, you're going to probably get different attributes than if it's a visitor.
Yep. Totally. Yeah. More data basically.
Yeah. Oh yeah. A lot more if it's the patient.
Right.
So let's just jump into the weeds here. So the way that it was, you talked about it with having a type, the way that it was actually implemented in development, did you have something like, did you have some sort of inheritance there? Did you create like a person base or, and then have some derived objects from that? Where sort of like you had the base with all the shared attributes that then got pulled down into the patient object and the visitor object. How was that actually, do you know how that was actually implemented?
How it was implemented? I would say probably not at this point because it was first implemented as just a patient in the system. And so they were pulling certain things. And so I don't know specifically how, but if I had to guess, I would say that like everything that's now come apart from that is probably sitting in its own table somewhere with the fields that are associated with it. Like for visitor, we're going to show this and this. For patient, we're going to show this, this, and this. Yeah. But if like a while ago we had thought about like, oh, there's going to be a person because it's not always going to be a patient, then probably would have saved some or made it more efficient, basically.
I mean, the way that I talk about it when it's like, okay, we need to have some sort of like this example, this is just such a great example. So in this situation, there's two ways that you can model it in an object map, right? One way is to create that object, that kind of base object that really, I know I'm going to correct myself, object base, not base object, because it's not really an object. You would never in your system instantiate just a person. It has to be either a patient or a visitor. There's no just person object, right? So you have this like group of attributes that then you could pull down to your patient and to your visitor. And so one way to model that is to create that person base. And then you have derived objects from that, the visitor and the patient. There was another one, right?
Yeah, staff would be another one.
Staff, visitor, patient, and staff. And then you would say, okay, these are going to pull everything from the person base. And then here's all the attributes that they have that are specific to them, to specific to the visitor and the staff and the patient. Mm-hmm. For this example, that seems like at least from a modeling perspective, the best way to do it because the variation is going to be so much, right? Mm-hmm. Like the patient is going to have so much more stuff. Attributes, I should say. End of the day, I'm using using filler words, and then the staff might have totally different attributes as well. And you know, that could be 12, 15, a couple dozen attributes that the patient or the visitor doesn't have. So from a modeling perspective on an object map, it makes sense to have separate columns. Mm-hmm. The other way you could do this is you have one column for your person and you have type on there. And then for the attributes, you basically key in and you say in your little object map, you say this attribute is for this type, this attribute is for this type, this attribute is for this type, right?
Yeah.
So when I talk about that though, I always say, model it what makes the most sense for modeling, but at the end of the day, a developer's going to decide how to actually implement it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm curious though, would a developer ever have condition, like, is there, wouldn't it always be some sort of base or, you know, whatever language you're using, you're going to use different words for it, whether it's a base or like a superclass and subclasses or something like that. Wouldn't you usually use some sort of inheritance versus that conditional logic?
I guess it depends on this, like how the developer is writing it probably. Right. Yeah.
So they might use conditional logic.
Yeah. It also depends at what level you're doing it. Right. Like, is it like you got an API call going out to different places and it's pulling in similar things and you just want it to be one thing in your app. And so you're kind of doing a bunch of conditional stuff in your code on the front end, or is the database on the back end already set up in the way that you're kind of describing?
Right.
Yeah. Okay. I think.
So would it be, so I get a lot of questions and I would like to hear what you think about this. Like I hear all the time that this process is a great way to help communicate with developers. I mean, you're saying that, and this is what it's like one of the patterns that I see when people write testimonials for object-oriented UX. It's like, this is helping me communicate with my developers so much better. Where do you think, is there any sticky points or like any kind of like, not risk isn't the right word, but like when you, any things to watch out for? Like if you're trying to, like if you're taking your developers and you're trying to build an object map with them, mm-hmm. like what kind of things should people watch out for as far as terminology or even framing the exercise?
That's a good question. I think it's super important to talk about the relationships and how the data is going to come across for multiple objects at a time. Like how things are going to be related. But I haven't had too many conversations where I've like had an issue communicating with the developer when I'm using this. So it's hard to say like what are the sticking points to watch out for. Most of the sticking points I've had have come when I'm trying to communicate with like product people, actually.
Okay. And just so developers just seem to get it, is what I'm hearing.
Yeah, definitely with product folks, it's like they're like used to the like story or the feature and not like what is this thing, is it at its base and how does it interact in each story? If that makes sense. So
it does make sense. And what is your advice for us?
The way I've done it honestly is I kind of like own that process and I like layer on some stories, but I'm like owning, okay, what are these objects and how are we going to have them interacting? So it feels less collaborative, which I'd like for it to be more collaborative, but I think that's kind of the style of work in general at probably my company, at least on the teams I've been at, where the UX designer is kind of owning their process and they're just making sure that everything stays consistent and like the objects are there. And they're having to kind of, so like other people aren't really participating in that process as much.
Yeah.
It's like agile, like the UX comes in and the sprint just kind of picks up. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think this is really good to know, for people to know, because I think that a lot of people get hung up on like all the things I say about how collaborative it should be. And then thinking like, if it's not collaborative, if not everybody's involved, then I shouldn't be doing it. And what I'm hearing is like, you know, don't ask for permission. just do the thing and it'll benefit your own work. And hopefully the more you do it, the more people will kind of be like, oh, what are you doing over there? I'm also just super curious. I mean, this is like, I just thought of this, but with remote work versus in-person work, like with in-person work, if you're like, object maps just look cool. So like, if you have this crazy color-coded object map, you know, on your glass wall or something in the office building, and you're out there, like, I feel like people would more like, I guess in my experience, this is what's happened too. Like people would come up and they would ask you, what is this? And then you could have a 20-minute conversation with them and even get some just like ad hoc feedback. But now working remotely, you can't really show that back. You can't show that like behind the scenes work as much.
Yeah, you kind of have to bring it up. Like what I do is just bring up my Miro board in a meeting or my Fig Jam or whatever. So that helps a little bit. But yeah, you're probably right that if I had something cool up on the walls and was like writing all over it, people would be into that. Yeah.
Well, that's great. I mean, that's a great way to do it. You know, even if people, if you're not able to like run these collaborative sessions and like do 4 weeks of object mapping with the whole team involved, like when you're in meetings, look for good times to be like, oh, let me share my screen and let me show you, you know, what I'm doing here, bringing it up and just showing it to people repeatedly. And hopefully they'll continue to get more and more curious about it.
Yeah. I think it works. I mean, yeah, one of the object maps I had actually made it into like a video, a promo video for something I was working on. So it does look cool. And it obviously helped.
Yeah. Very cool. Okay. So to wrap us up, I actually want to bring this back to CrossFit. Okay. Let's go full circle, because there's actually a question, because we were jumping around, a question that I didn't get to. It's not really a question. It's more of a thought that I want to get your ideas on. So CrossFit that you're very involved in is this super successful movement. I don't know much about the history of it. I just know that all of a sudden they were everywhere. Yeah. CrossFit gyms everywhere. And I'm curious on your, like, I feel like potentially the success of CrossFit, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I just want to see how you react to this, is there's this whole language around it. There's this whole community. There's the workouts of the day. There's like specific exercises that get done on certain days. There's this rhythm and this sort of like feeling like you're, you know, you're doing the workout that everybody's doing, right? Like they're the workout of the day, like every all across the country, the world is doing the same workout. Is that right?
It depends, but I'll explain it a little bit. Yeah.
Ish. Yeah. I'd love to hear you explain it a bit, but yeah, I just wonder like what you feel like is like a big part of the success of CrossFit. I mean, it's a great workout, but there's a lot of great workouts out there. And I just feel like there's a whole lot of information architecture around it, around this community. And like, there's like these pieces that feel like I can pull these pieces together to create these workouts. And there's also people that are doing those workouts. And then there's data, right? Like you track a bunch of data as well. Tell us a little bit about how that works and kind of if you feel like that might play into some of the success of CrossFit.
Yeah, I think the point about it being like, I think at its core, it's about like all of these people are having a shared experience, even if they have to modify the workout a little bit. Because what CrossFit does really well is it's come up with, we have all these movements that we do, but we know how to like scale it infinitely or modify it infinitely. So you could do a regular push-up, but if you need to make it easier, you do it from your knees. If you need to make it easier, you do it on a wall. So it's almost like there's a like base and then we've got all these different types, yes. Right? So it is kind of, yeah, it's cool to think about it in an OUXE way. There's some workouts that are considered like benchmarks. And so those will get done. And like things like if you're the word Fran or the name Fran or Christine, mm-hmm. or some of these, like those are benchmark workouts that a lot of people have had the experience of doing. And so I think that brings people together really well. But different gyms will have their own programming. Like typically each gym is doing their own thing and maybe they have someone on staff or maybe they're purchasing program from someone else. So things that people are doing different things, but the like exercises at their core are the same and the goal of like trying to make you good at everything basically. Uh-huh. And so it's about like gaining skills across all different things. So you're not just like running every day, you're trying to become competent in like a bunch of different things.
Are there apps for this? There's gotta be apps, right? There's gotta be CrossFit.
Yeah, totally.
Apps.
Yeah. There's like a really great, There's tons of apps, but there's Beyond the Whiteboard, which is a great one where they aggregate data and you can see kind of like if you plug in your score for a workout, where on the curve do I fall? Like am I like 90th percentile, 80th, like based on how I did the workout. So there's a lot of like tracking and like comparing and that kind of thing. Yeah.
I would love to like analyze them from an OUX perspective. Cause I just like, I'm like building an object map in my head right now. I'm like, okay, you've got, cause there's the workout of the day, or there's like the different workout, not there's the workout. And then there's the, what do you call them? Like the exercises, like the actual move. What's it called in the
CrossFit? Yeah. Movement.
So there's the movements, and then there's the different levels of the movement. And then there's tracking my data on the movement. So there's like these relative attributes that are, you know, relative to each individual user. And I might see where I fall, because there's the roll up data versus my particular data. And then there's my data over time as well, which is something that actually was a question that came up in this cohort 5 about what do you do when you have an attribute that's tracked over time? I actually don't have a great answer for that, but those are things, right? That would be a good example of showing an attribute over time. It's like my performance on the workout.
Right. And they also do an interesting thing too. Well, some people will kind of do this more mentally. I haven't seen it in a UI yet, but where they say like, okay, in workouts where I have to do jump rope followed by pull-ups and my heart rate's really high, I tend to be not as good. So I think in this workout, I'm also going to be not as good. So you start making these comparisons about like when I have a movement in this sequence or in this type of workout, this is how it feels or how I perform. So there's a lot of like neat things about like context, right? Like what context am I doing this movement in the workout?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. There's a ton of information architecture around this and data. Do you think it's like that affects the type of person that's attracted to it?
I think so. I mean,
like data nerds.
Yeah. Who's attracted to CrossFit? There are a lot of data nerds, like a lot of people who just like love tracking information about their like body and their health, you know. Mm-hmm. You've got a ton of people, like there's an official like fitness monitor for CrossFit.
My gosh.
A lot of people into that. I think it attracts people who are like really into self-improvement, who like really want to think about like, how can I become 1% better today? And so like you find a lot of people who have that personality of like, they're always just pushing to be a better version of themselves. And so they're really analytical and they tend to think about like, there's like a million different movements and how can I get better at, something today? So it is very like almost like detail oriented, analytical, hardworking kind of people. So,
And to be able to, I would love to look at some of those apps and see how good they are.
Maybe you can build something. Yeah.
Well, so actually my last question for you is, you know, with all of your interests, I mean, you're so passionate about all of these areas. Like what's your dream project?
Dream project.
Design a CrossFit app.
Maybe not. I don't know. I can say like what the attributes of it would be, I guess. Like, I just want something that's going to help a lot of people, that makes like, that empowers people, that when they pick it up, they feel kind of superhuman, right? Like, or when they use it, it makes their life better in some way. I would want it to be health related. I probably would want it to like help them if they want to like have a behavior change in the terms of the way they eat or the way they move. I would want it to help them do that. Yeah. And in terms of like the work I would do on it, I would love to just be involved, like as a generalist, like do some of the research, do some of the design, do some of the dev, and maybe be working with people who are like experts in each of those domains, but I'm like the go-between that kind of flows. That would be sweet.
That would be sweet. That's awesome. Yeah. All right. Very cool. Thanks for joining me today. That was awesome.
Thanks for having me. This was so fun.
Thank you so much for listening. I truly hope you enjoyed this episode. Please visit objectorientux.com/podcast for show notes. Our soundtrack is Fighter by Ruby Vell, courtesy of Sugaroo Records. Happy OUXing!